So, good morning, everybody. My name is Gregor Pupink. I'm from Strasbourg. I would like to thank the university for giving me the occasion to give you a presentation this morning and to participate to this very interesting conference. I am in Strasbourg. My main activity is to work close to the European Court of Human Rights on cases on religious freedom. I run an organization which is named European Center for Law and Justice. It is a non-profit legal organization that advocates for religious freedom and human dignity. We follow most of the important cases on religious freedom at the Court of Strasbourg. So I think rather than doing a large presentation on the theory of religious freedom and so on, I will give you maybe some information on the two last most important cases from the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights on religious freedom. So as you may know, recently we have an increasing number of cases coming to the Court of Strasbourg. The Court of Strasbourg, you might all know, covers 47 member states. And so among those cases, which are more and more numbered, we can see really the issue of this conference today. How can we handle pluralism in democratic societies? How can we handle respect for traditions, culture, identities, and in the meantime, respect for pluralism and identity of the minorities, right to believe, right not to believe? So there are real difficulties. The first case I would like to tell you about is the case concerning conscientious objection to military service. It's a case against Armenia in which the court has recognized the right for people drawn on their religion to object to doing military service. It's a big and new case from the Grand Chamber of the Court of Strasbourg. The second case I will tell you about is the famous Lotzi case against Italy, which concerns the display of crucifix in state public schools. I will try to make short my first explanation on the Armenian case, even if it needs to be a bit philosophical maybe, and then move to the Italian case. Concerning the Italian case, I'm open to questions. I just would like to say that I have been personally deeply involved in the argumentation of this case, along on the side with the Italian government and as an NGO. And after we won the case, the Italian government made me a knight as a thanks for the help, which means that the acknowledgement of participation into this case, just to explain. So, concerning the consciousness objection case, on July 7th, 2011, in the case Bayatayan versus Armenia, the Grand Chamber of the Court of Strasbourg issued a landmark ruling concerning the conviction of a Jehovah Witness in 2003 for his refusal to participate in military service. The court determined the applicability of Article 9 of the Convention, which protects freedom of religion, and applicable to conscientious objection to military service. The applicant, a Jehovah Witness, was imprisoned for his refusal to perform military service, despite the fact that Armenia, upon joining the Council of Europe in 2001, introduced civilian service as an alternative to compulsory military service within 3 years. This historic ruling from the Grand Chamber overturns a very well-established case law, in particular, a precedent-setting ruling from 2009. The ruling abolished the former commission approach, according to which the original intention of the state not to include an explicit right to conscientious objection in the drafting of the convention prevented its jurisprudential creation in the drafting of the convention. Indeed, while drafting the convention, the contracting state refused to follow the proposal, this one, I quote, "The conscientious objection who oppose to war for religious reasons will be exempted from military service." This was a proposal of inclusion into the convention that has been explicitly refused by the state when they draft the convention. So the court clearly went against the original intention of the drafter of the convention. The court based its new approach on the doctrine of the practical and effective rights and on the idea that the convention has to be seen as a living instrument, according to which the convention must be interpreted according to the circumstances of the time. Even if the state refused to recognize a right to conscientious objection to military service while drafting the convention, for the court, this does not necessarily imply that the court cannot, under certain limitations, deduce such development from the convention text through its own interpretation. This may be done if a new development can be firmly grounded on the existing right, if the member state consents to this new obligation, and if this consent is part of a broader consensus within the other contracting state. In the present case, it can be reasonably argued that a right to conscientious objection to military service may derive from the right to freedom of convention, conscience and religion. In its opinion, the court observed the evolution that took place since the first decisions of the Commission in the early 80s. It noted the existence of a real consensus among member states in Europe recognizing the right to conscientious objection to military service and duly considers the Armenia engagement to provide for conscientious objection while they joined the Council of Europe. The court recognized the right to conscientious objection to military service by establishing the applicability of Article 9, even if there is another provision in the Convention, Article 4, which clearly provides that forced labor should not be considered at as a banning, I will read, that forced labor should not be considered as applying to military service, which by contrario means that military service, according to the convention, was legal and could not be opposed by people. The enjoyment of the right to conscious objection to military service for an individual requires that the person prove that their objection is based on religious grounded and that the state has the possibility to satisfy this requirement. For instance, the establishment of a civilian service as an alternative to compulsory military service. As considered by the court, this right to conscientious objection, based on religion, could be applicable in fields other than military service. Indeed, the question of one's enjoyment of such a right is currently before the court in several cases. The first one concerns a public servant's refusal to conduct same-sex civil partnerships ceremonies, and a second one, a sex and relationship therapist refusing to counsel same-sex couples. In both cases, the parties objected on the grounds of their conscience and belief. In the case of the first applicant, after the Civil Partnership Act of 2005 in UK entered in force, the applicant was permitted to make informal arrangement with his colleagues to swap work so that she would not be required to conduct such ceremonies. At the time, two of her colleagues who were homosexuals usually did the ceremonies. After she received complaint in 2006, disciplinary proceedings were instituted against this lady. In the second case, the applicant was also suspended pending disciplinary investigation after he and later dismissed because also of his refusal to counsel on a sexual approach same-sex couples. There is currently a third case before the Grand Chamber pending, which is the Ehrmann case versus Germany. This case is also very interesting. It concerns the refusal from a landowner to permit hunting on his land because he is personally object to hunting based on his convictions. So those cases where we speak about objection to military service, objection to same-sex marriage, objection to hunting, but also objection to practicing abortions, for example, or euthanasia, are all based on conscience or religion. And the court has more and more cases like this, and it is becoming difficult for the court to find good criteria on how we can handle, on the European level, accommodate personal belief, conscience, and the law. So because this right is increasingly invoked for various situations, there is a real need to deepen its understanding. I would like to briefly propose you the main idea I have, I think, on this issue is really that we need, as advocates or persons interested in religious freedom, to clearly try to make an effort to do not fall within the full subjectivity of the issue, but try to find really criteria that can apply from both a rational and a religious point of view. So I would like to say that first, conscientious objection is not an autonomous notion. Conscientious objection is not a good or a right in itself. It has always to be estimated according to the object to which it applies. Conscientious objection has to be estimated according to the object to which it applies. For instance, conscientious objection to slavery is good because slavery is bad. On the other hand, conscientious objection to education is bad because instruction is good. Conscientious objection manifests, in fact, a relationship of morality. Therefore, the right to conscientious objection is not grounded on the goodness or the badness of an individual conscience who personally objects to instruction or slavery. It is grounded on the objective evilness of slavery. That is to say, in the objective wrongness of the practice objected to. A conscientious judgment is a judgment about the rightness or the wrongness of particular acts. So, it is easy to agree on the objective evilness of slavery, torture, voluntary killings, and even on abortion or euthanasia. But it is sometimes more difficult to establish the objective wrongness of other practices. This may apply to military service, blood transfer, or some vaccinations. For those practices, their supposed wrongness may be grounded only on subjective and religious prescriptions, rather than on prescriptions of conscience. They are religious prescriptions, and not necessarily prescriptions of the conscience. For those strictly religious prescriptions, the objection is not grounded on conscience anymore because it doesn't comply necessarily with moral rationality, but it is grounded on subjective religious grounds. Some religions object to military service, blood transfer, and vaccination, even if those practices objectively are not immoral per se. Therefore, conscientious objection to blood transfer cannot be grounded on conscience. At the opposite, however, it can be grounded on one's religious belief. Concerning same-sex unions, it is doubtful that a religious belief is necessary to object to it. In fact, homosexuality has and still is commonly considered as objectively wrong. And also, you cannot deduce the religion of the objector based on its objection, whereas you can deduce the religion of someone who objects eating beef on Friday. You cannot deduce the religion of the one who objects to conduct civil partnership. So it's to show the criteria. Objecting to eating pork every day or just eating beef on Friday doesn't create any real problems, because the common good of society is not directly affected by private religious prescriptions. Another problem arises, however, when someone objects to a practice that concerns the common good based on their religious or subjective ethical prescriptions. This problem is observed with objections to military service and so on that are aimed at preserving the health and security of society, for example, for the vaccinations. This is also the problem in the case of hunting, for example, the German case. Hunting is, in some extent, necessary to preserve the diversity of nature and to eat, sometimes in some countries. So, this is why conscientious objection to military service based on conscience may exist normally when the military service doesn't pursue the common good. Indeed, the European Court of Human Rights, as well as international law, have recognized until now that conscious objection to military service may be required if and only if the use of the force doesn't pursue the common good. The court articulated recently this argument in a case against Czech Republic, Poledneva, from June 2011, and it reaffirmed this case, a former finding in a case against Germany, KHW, from 2001. The KHW case concerned a soldier from Eastern Germany who received order to shoot a trespasser at the border. The court considered that it was okay to condemn this man, even if he shot by order. Because according to the Court of Strasbourg, this soldier should have known. He should have known as an ordinary citizen that firing an unarmed person who were merely trying to escape his country infringed fundamental norms. Which means the court referred to the conscience of the soldier. The soldier should have known. He should not have obeyed. He should have objected. Because what was asked to him was against common good and against human rights. In the other case, more recent, Poledneva decision, it was concerning a woman's murder conviction for having acted as a state prosecutor in the 50s in a political trial. So she was judged in this case, and she led the man, I would say, to death. And this is the same story as the first one. The court said, Mrs. Poledneva should have been conscientious. This is a quote. She should have been conscientious that it was not fair to condemn a man in a fake trial. And therefore, it was normal that she'd been convinced after the state been freed from communism, even if she obeyed to orders for her superiors. So she should have objected. So, in fact, in those cases, the Court of Strasbourg just apply the fundamental principle of one of the principles of Nuremberg Code of Ethics, code, the fourth principle of Nuremberg, which says that the fact that a person acted pursuant to order of his government or of a superior does not relieve him from responsibility under international law, provided a moral choice, was in fact possible to him. So this is the ground of the right to conscientious objection and even of the duty, the ability to have a moral choice. So, comparing conscientious objection in the field of abortion and military service, it can be said that in the medical field, conscientious objection is based on a clear moral ground, as it is always objectively unjust to put an end to an innocent human life, before birth or after. Meanwhile, in the field of military service, the moral ground for conscientious objection cannot be so clearly established because participation to the protection of the society is a just task. Since military service cannot be objectively considered as bad in itself, a permanent and general objection to its accomplishment is more of a religious objection than a conscientious objection. Whereas, at the opposite, objection to abortion is more a conscientious objection, whereas a religious one. To conclude those remarks, the conscientious objection principle proclaims the moral and legal right and duty of consciously object to demands and order through legal as long as they are unjust. In just situations, this right doesn't really exist. Very differently, an objection based on a purely religious or objective or subjective ethical belief or conviction calls for the recognition of the autonomy of the individual sphere towards society. It asks society to be tolerant towards their individual conviction or belief to the extent permitted by common good, or as the court usually to say, by the general interest of the society. In some situations, the objection can be grounded both on conscience and on religion. This is the case, for instance, on objection to abortion, slavery, or prostitution, which are aimed at protecting human life and dignity. In most of traditions, and Christian tradition especially, respecting human life and dignity is both a conscientious and a religious prescription. It is essential that reason and faith, from a Christian point of view, fides et ratio, should not contradict each other. Faith, from a Christian point of view, doesn't prevail over reason. As Thomas Aquinas said, grace does not destroy nature. Because the society in most of the Western Europe is not always willing to perceive the objective wrongness of practices such as abortion or euthanasia, the believers who conscientiously object to those practices may ask society to tolerate them only as a religious-based objection. As a result, objection to abortion becomes, in the eyes of society, a purely subjective and irrational individual opinion that may or not be tolerated in regard to other social interests. Those claiming for the recognition of the right to conscientious objection, grounded both on conscience and on religion, should not renounce claiming this right on the primary ground of conscience, rather than claiming it only in the name of religious tolerance. Furthermore, the court tasked to elaborate on this right should be careful not to consider such objections as purely religious. Otherwise, this would be a loss, not only for justice, but more deeply for the common sense and for the rationality of society. Thank you. So this is... So in the remaining time, I will have 10 small minutes. I would like to tell you about the second important case. It is a case against Italy, Lozzi case. So as you know, the court had to face a huge difficulty, and the Lozzi case, the Italian case, is the case that has caused the biggest noise, the biggest activity, the biggest press, the biggest media in all the history, not only of the court, but of the Council of Europe. So the Lozzi case is a case that has been brought by a lady and supported by a very good lawyer and some groups against Italy. And this lady was asking the Court of Strasbourg to declare that the display of crucifix in the public school that her children attend was contrary to her right to educate her children according to her belief and contrary to her right to the freedom and to the right of the freedom of the children. So what is important in this case is that first decision came in 2009 from a chamber, which is just a section below the Grand Chamber. And by 7 votes, by unanimity, this chamber ruled that the display of crucifix infringed the right of the children and of the mother, mainly of the mother, to educate her children according to her belief. So the court said that in Italy, the presence of crucifix on the wall of classrooms goes against the European Convention of Human Rights. So, and they declared that by 7 votes. It caused a lot of, discussions in Italy and in all Europe. Then, what was discussed in this case, mainly, in fact, beyond the idea of the presence of the crucifix, the case became much bigger than just the issue at stake. What was behind this case, according to me, was really the conflict of, another conflict in some extent of civilization, but which only exists in Europe or in Western countries. And this conflict, this kind of war of religion, was a kind of war between the current modern ideology of human rights, on one hand, and on the other hand, the Christian tradition of Europe. So what was at stake was really the conflict between who would prevail. Would modern post-religious human right and post-natural law human right would prevail in name of pluralism and respect and tolerance on traditions, national traditions, or would national traditions, identity, cultures, and so on, could continue to exist in the current Europe? So the idea was, I would say, also a conflict between what we used to call the Christian Democrat approach, or on the other hand, the postmodern or liberal Democrat approach. The court made this the first decision re-explaining what should be the school. So the first decision was based on a general affirmation that school, teaching, education should be aimed at developing rationalism, criticism in a neutral environment. Whereas this requirement is not included in the convention at all. The Grand Chamber had finally to decide on this case. 10 states joined Italy and backed Italy in support of its position. In addition to those 10 states, we had about 11 others who took publicly a stand on the side of Italy. So as a total, we had 22 states among 47 who publicly said that they wanted the crucifix to stay. They wanted the Christian tradition, the Christian identity in Europe to have a right to stay in the future of Europe. So the Grand Chamber finally, by 15 votes against 2, ruled in favor of Italy, considering that it is okay to keep the crucifix in the classrooms. Why did the court do that? My vision is clearly that it is not really a political ruling. Many people will say the court was under pressure. It is true, the court was under pressure, and the court put itself under pressure. But I think that the last ruling was much more legal than the first one. The first ruling started explaining, you know, what should be the school. This was a political statement. And according to this statement, what should be the school, they deduced norms, new norms, including secularism of schools. The second ruling did not say what should be the schools. They just recognized that the states can, according to the convention, decide what is the school. It's nothing in the convention that say what should be the school. And therefore, the court said, okay, now look clearly what is the impact of the crucifix. Can we consider that the presence of a crucifix is enough to ban to stop a woman, a mother, to teach her children? Is the presence of a crucifix enough to indoctrinate people? So the idea is that the presence of crucifix is not forcing person to believe or to change their opinion or not to believe and so on. They just said, okay, according to the level of protection granted by the convention, the presence of crucifix is not enough to see an infringement. If it were compulsory religious teaching, this would be above the limitation accepted by the convention. But the simple presence of a non-active symbol, we do not force people to act or ban them to do not act, is not enough for the convention and for the court. So this was the reasoning. 1 more minute. So there are a few aspects that can be also discussed. Clearly, the Grand Chamber ruling could have been much shorter. The court said that it doesn't believe that the simple presence of crucifix is enough to create a violation of the right of the mother, because there is no impact on the mother and so on, and not really on the children, not sufficient impact. But we could ask, why did the court in some other cases say that it is okay to ban the headscarf in schools? So how can we explain the diversity of the court case law in terms of religion when we compare to Switzerland, so the Dalab case on headscarf, the cases in Italy, the ones in Turkey, the one in France, and so on? This is important. First, we have make the distinction between positive freedom of religion and negative freedom of religion. When you see the lady, the teacher in Switzerland, who was teacher, she wanted to do something. She wanted to manifest her religion by putting a headscarf. The court always considered that you can limit the positive manifestations of religion. You can ask someone to abstain to do something quite easily, according to the national context, according to the traditions. Switzerland is partly secular. Turkey is very secular. So according to the France is secular. So according to the context, it is okay to ask someone to refrain, to abstain, to manifest his religion. As long, of course, as this person can have his religious life otherwise. It is different from the court to force someone to do something. It is different to force someone to attend a ceremony or an education service or compulsory education school. So the court always says it is more easy to ban than to force. And this is a big difference. In the Lotzi case, there is no such obligation. Nobody is forced to do anything, and nobody is forced to abstain from doing anything. They just are asked to tolerate the presence of a symbol on the wall. So it's very different. Also, concerning majority religion, the court also tried to give some, the Grand Chamber gave also some explanations on those aspects. What can be today, in our pluralist period, the legitimacy of majority religions? Do majority religions have a specific legitimacy in states? It's a difficult question. Can we consider that Islam has a specific legitimacy in Turkey, or Catholicism has a specific legitimacy in Italy? The court again consider the context of each case. And the court acknowledged that in Turkey, there is more Muslims than Christians, and there is more kinds of Muslims than Alevi. And so it is okay for the court of Strasbourg to have an emphasis on a specific Islam on Turkey rather than on Alevi. It is also okay for the court to recognize, that in Italy, Christianity, Catholicism is part of the reality of the state. The court has to judge on realities. And the reality of Italy is its deep Christian identity and tradition. And so the court says, okay, you can have that, as long as you don't force people not to believe or to believe something else. So the difference between two cases, the first decision and the second decision. On the first decision, the court said how the state must be, what should be its own identity. The state should be secular. This was what said the first decision. The second decision says what the state should not do. So it is a difference between to be and to do. First decision, Italy should be secular. Second decision, Italy must respect religious freedom, acknowledging its particular identity and tradition and so on. So the difference between being and doing, this is the rationale of the difference between the two cases. Thank you.